In 1610, a noblewoman is arrested who may or may not be the most prolific female serial killer of all time.
The sky was perfectly clear at the time, and she said it felt like large snowflakes.
I'm Fraser Coffeen.
And I'm Jennifer Coffeen.
And this is Creepy History. We are back. Welcome back, everyone.
Yay!
Season 3 continues on.
It does.
This is a true statement. This is a statement of fact.
Rolls on like a train.
Yes, a creepy train rolling through history.
Oh, what do you think's on a creepy train?
Oh, I mean,
they have like haunted houses, but they don't have haunted trains. I think being on a haunted train would be so upsetting.
Would it? There has to be some sort of haunted train thing.
There probably is something somewhere.
That seems like a great idea.
Because I know, if there's not, then we need to not edit this out.
Yeah, we'll cut this out so that nobody ever hears it, and so we can make our millions.
We're going to make a haunted train.
Yes.
Because here's the thing that's so upsetting. You can't get off of it.
True.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, you're trapped on the train.
Nor do you have, like, in a haunted house, you can be like, oh, I'm scared, I'm going to kind of run through this room.
Yeah.
No dice. You're just on the train.
Yeah, because the train is so narrow, like, there's just nowhere to go but forward or backwards.
Yes, yes.
Oh, ooh, you're this so is a good trapped! Idea.
Now, the train's got to be going somewhere, obviously, right? It's not just stopped in the station.
I'm assuming.
It's traveling.
It's going to hell.
Well, this got a lot more complicated for us to make now that we have a train going to hell.
Where else are you going on a haunted train? That's all I'm going to say.
I'm just saying that you probably are going from, to like an abandoned station. Then everybody gets off at the abandoned station for a few minutes.
You just got to run for it. Everyone just scatters out.
This is going to be, we're going to make a lot of money with this idea.
This is also very disturbing to think about.
It's great.
Now I just have like these awful images of like, you know, going down like a train hallway with like one of those clowns chasing you.
Oh, sure. You've added the clown. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Doing the chainsaw bit inside the train.
Oh, the worst.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is good. This is a good idea.
And then you know how like the doors makes it a little noise. Everybody's trying, you know, you have like tiny train car doors, but it's such a small area.
Like that, What's that 70s British movie about the killer on the train? Where they're like, mind the doors, mind the gap, whatever it is.
Oh,
that
the one we saw at the horror festival?
Yeah, it's got Donald Pleasance in it.
Yes.
It's called, like, maybe it might be Raw Meat, perhaps. That might be what it's called. I think it might be called Raw Meat.
Possibly.
Anyway, that movie. See,
wait,
creepy.
It didn't have, stuff didn't happen on a train.
I guess not.
There was just a lot of shots of, like, them being on the train.
True.
In, like, the tube, right?
Midnight Meat Train. Things happen on the train. On the Midnight Meat Train.
So, wait. There's a movie called Raw Meat and then a movie called Midnight Meat Train?
Midnight Meat Train is a Clive Barker story that
yes.
got turned into a movie that we also saw at the Music Box of Horrors.
That's the one I'm thinking of. That's, like, the British couple. She's got the sort of mullet haircut.
I don't think so. It's like a photographer, and I think it's Bradley Cooper, I think. I think it's an early Bradley Cooper movie.
Maybe I'm thinking of Raw Meat.
I think you're thinking of Raw Meat. Okay. Donald Pleasance is in Raw Meat.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyways.
So anyway, there's your haunted trains. If you're in the mood for some scary train movies, those are our recommendations.
Until you can find a haunted train... Then go see the movies about scary trains.
Which may or may not be called Raw Meat, but certainly is called Midnight Meat Train.
Yeah.
Confident in that one.
Yeah, all right.
There you go.
So, we digress, but that was very important information.
No, it's not digress, it's very important.
All right, I'm ready for your cocktail.
Okay.
It's very pretty.
It's very pretty. I thought it would look a little more kind of like aggressively red, but it's a little... It's
pinkish.
It's a little pink. So, what we have here is a blood orange bourbon sour.
Ooh.
So, it's your kind of standard issue sour, right? Like a whiskey sour or a whatever sour, but with bourbon, and obviously then with blood orange juice in it as well.
Is it fresh blood orange juice?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Fresh blood orange juice, fresh lemon, fresh lime, simple syrup, and bourbon. That's what we've got.
Were you supposed to have a grapefruit in there?
No.
Oh,
why?
Okay.
Did you eat the grapefruit?
I did.
No, it was not for this. I would have warned you to not eat it.
I ate it earlier today, and I was like, oops.
Nope, no worries,
okay. Good.
Now, I feel a little guilty about this, because blood orange is a pretty seasonal fruit. So for mm-hmm. our faithful listeners who are perhaps trying to make the cocktails, you might struggle to find blood orange for yourself to make this.
What season?
Winter.
Oh.
The ones that I got, I don't know that they were the very best quality. They seemed like they were kind of on the fading out of being good. So let's give it a shot. My bold prediction, you will hate it.
Oh, why? Because it's bourbon. Strong?
Bourbon. Yeah. I don't think it's your thing.
All right.
Cheers.
Cheers. Oh, jeez.
Yeah, that was exactly my prediction. That was it. That was the sound. My gosh. That was the sound I anticipated.
It's so soury. And bourbony.
It's a lot of bourbon.
By the color, you think it's going to be sweet.
It looks like it's going to be like a Cosmo.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And then you taste it and you're like, what?
Yeah.
All right.
It totally looks like it's going to be a fruity poolside drink.
Yeah. I'm just going to put that over there. It's, I think, you know what, honestly, I'm not a huge bourbon fan, but I can see if you like it because it's not, you know, I don't like my, like, cocktail, I don't like stuff too sweet either. So if you're a person who doesn't like a sweet cocktail, but you want it to have, like, a little bit of a fruity taste, like, this is a good choice.
The blood orange and, like, the sour mix and stuff like that, it definitely cuts into the bourbon here. Like, it's not
It does. It's not super bourbon-y.
Aggressively bourbon. It's, like some of the drinks we've
the
had.
The bourbon is, like, you know, a further down the layers.
But it's there. Whew!
Yeah, it's there.
Oh, boy.
It bites you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure I'll make that one again.
It's very sour.
It's pretty sour.
Yeah, you need, like, something.
Yeah.
Maybe it would be better if it had, like, a little something bubbly in it.
Maybe.
I think everything's better with some bubbly stuff in it.
I think probably, like, hardcore cocktail people are, like, appalled that you just suggested putting anything bubbly with bourbon. That's probably a big no.
I'm just saying that things are a little better if they're bubbly. That's all I'm saying.
Listen, it's a modern age of cocktails. We can try whatever we want.
That's true.
I'm taking one more sip.
All right. I'm going to pass. I'm just going to look at it.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I'd make it again. Interesting.
Yeah. All right.
On we go.
If you like sour bourbon, this drink is for you.
That goes on the poster for it.
If you like claustrophobic horror, ride on a horror train.
There you go. This is the episode for you, fans of sour bourbon and claustrophobic horror. All right. On to my story. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. So.
Yeah, go ahead. I was
No. Based on my teaser, you
based
got
on
a
your teaser, I think this is one that I was going to do.
Probably in the back pocket for a long time. This is the tale of Elizabeth Bathory.
Yay!
Yes. Now, Elizabeth Bathory is certainly a well-known figure who I had to go through every single episode that we've done to be like, surely we've done an episode about her at some point, but we haven't.
No, it was on my list, and then I think I just got distracted by other things.
Yeah.
I wrote and directed a play.
Oh.
About Elizabeth Bathory. You know, remember it.
Yes.
Like a short. It was a short. Yeah.
I had forgotten it was about her.
Wasn't great. I think I was 22.
It's all right.
Maybe 23.
It's all right. I had forgotten it was about her. Okay.
Yeah.
There you go.
For sure.
Well, now I feel guilty that I've taken your thunder.
No, it's okay.
Okay.
Because I should have done it earlier.
How much research into Elizabeth Bathory did you do for your play?
I mean, not as much as I probably would have done now.
All right.
Excellent. I have no memory, honestly, of writing it, or I don't think I knew what I was doing.
Sure.
And, you know how it goes.
Making theater, man. We're doing it. Living the life. All right.
Yeah.
Well, here's my approach. This was one of the ones I've done a couple episodes like this. I really like the let's take a creepy, well-known historical figure and dive into what the true story is behind them.
Sure.
You know, I'm always really intrigued by that. So this is one of those episodes. Put it next to like the Nostradamus one and the Dracula one.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's my jam.
All right.
So here we go. So Elizabeth Bathory. So she was born in the year 1560 mm-hmm. in Hungary. The town, now some tough pronunciations in this, so maybe best that you didn't tackle it. There's some tough ones. Sorry.
No, that's fair. It's real fair, actually.
She was born in the town of Nyírbátor.
All right.
Nyírbátor.
That sounds good.
Nyírbátor.
Yeah, that works.
Which maybe is a part of Transylvania now. I'm a little bit unclear. But Hungary-Transylvania border area. And she was born into a very prestigious family, the Bathory family, Hungarian nobles.
fancy.
Very fancy. How, you know, notable? Well, both her grandfather and her uncle on the other side were both the Vovoid of Transylvania. Our faithful listeners may recall that Vovoid of Transylvania is also the title that Dracula held. It's like king. They were basically.
It was called the Vovoid?
We went through this in an earlier episode.
Did we?
This was Dracula's title, V-O-I-V-O-D. We had a whole discussion about it. There's a band with this name. You don't remember this whole discussion?
Oh, gosh. Sometimes my memory really scares me.
Again, I could be pronouncing that wrong, because the I is before the second V.
Yeah.
Voivod. But that doesn't sound like the way they would say it.
It just sounds like you're trying to...
Anyway.
Voivod.
Yeah.
Okay, so, anyway. Yes.
They were rulers of Transylvania.
Yeah.
Her other uncle was the king of Poland.
Whoa.
Very, very connected.
Yeah.
To give a little bit of perspective here, since we're talking about Vovoid of Transylvania, and we have talked about this before, again, she was born in...
For anyone else.
Yes, exactly. Again, she was born in 1560. Dracula held that title in the mid-1400s. So we're about 100 years
later.
Post-Dracula here.
All right.
So there we go. A sip. So sour. So as a child, she had epilepsy. And the way that they treated it, because they didn't know what the heck they were doing back then, is they would give her some blood to drink and a piece of human skull to eat.
What? And what?
Yeah.
Where
drink
did,
some blood what and blood? Eat this skull.
Like blood from just an animal, probably? But I mean, they obviously said a human skull.
That I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
You just have, like pieces of human skulls, like, laying around?
And then
are they, like, dried, like, beef jerky? What's going
on?
I
don't know. You're the nobles. You can get it. You can get it.
Disgusting. And then you just, like, chow, like...
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you're not... How are you eating that?
I don't know. Powder, maybe? Shooting Who knows? It? Anyway. So she ate... ate some skull, drank some blood.
Shocking that it didn't work.
I know. No, somehow it didn't do it. Maybe... When she was young, maybe she witnessed the torture of some officers, possibly. Maybe there was witchcraft practiced in the home, maybe.
Yeah.
And by multiple accounts, it seems that when she was 13, she had a child, an illegitimate child, who she had an affair with a peasant and had a child who was then given up.
Okay, no 13-year-olds having an affair.
Well, yes.
Number one. And, yeah, but I mean, I know this is 1560. Yes. So, like, really, some not great things.
So not great things. She had a rough,
it was not, no good.
A rough life.
It seems like a lot of lawlessness.
Yes.
And I'm going to go on a limb and say, if you have pieces of skull and blood around in a cup to give people to drink, like, there's, you know, I don't know if it's witchcraft, but there's something going on in your house.
Transylvania stuff.
Yeah. Oof. Yeah. All right.
So then in 1575, at the age of 15, as you did back then, she got married.
Yeah.
Don't want to become an old spinster at 16.
Well, I mean, that'd be terrible. How long did they live?
Right, yeah, true. True. And she got married to a guy named Count Ferenc Nedadzsi.
Mm-hmm.
Nedadzsi. Yes.
Is he like 14?
I do not know how old Ferenc was. No, Ferenc was, I bet you Ferenc was like 28.
Oh.
Probably something like that, you know? And they moved to Ferenc's castle in the Carpathian Mountains.
Oh, that sounds scary.
Home of Dracula. Moved to his castle. And he, in fact, gave his castle, his lands, to Elizabeth as a wedding gift. So she now owns Castle Nedadzsi in the Carpathian Mountains. Then, shortly thereafter, Ferenc went off to war. He was leading the Hungarian army against the Ottomans. We talked a lot about that again during the Dracula time.
Yes, you do.
So he was. So he's off at war, and they had together had the various reports. They had a number of children, maybe five, maybe eight, something, some amount of kids. They
had. No,
it's a little bit unclear. And those kids were largely raised by their governess.
Yeah, sure.
Obviously, as you would expect. And finally, in 1604, so that is about 30 years into their marriage, she's 44 at the time, Ferenc dies. Natural causes.
That's pretty good for that.
Not bad.
You know, 44? Yeah.
Well, she's 44. Again, I don't know how old he is.
Oh, okay.
He's probably, I'm sure he's
older than that, I know.
So Ferenc
dies.
Especially
going to war and stuff.
Yeah. And it's around the time that Ferenc dies that the rumors begin.
She's got, I got a lot of time on my hands
yeah.
and a lot of money.
there just starts to be weird things that people start hearing. People start talking about strange things happening at the castle out there in the Carpathian Mountains mm-hmm. with this woman who now she never remarries. You know, she's sure. on her own, and just, you know, strange rumors start coming up. So after these rumors start kind of bubbling up and people are like, you know, what's going on? Are some people disappearing from the town? We're hearing weird things are happening at the castle. Enough of these rumors come up that in 1610, the king, King Matthias II, orders an investigation.
That is really bad when the king is like, I'm going to step in and get involved.
Oh, not just any king, too. You ready to hear this guy's title?
Yeah.
You might say, king of what? Here is King Matthias II's title. He is the Holy Roman Emperor. He is the Archduke of Austria. He is the King of Hungary, and he's the King of Croatia.
He just gave himself all those titles.
He gave himself those titles by conquering all those places. King he's Matthias II.
Like, call me this now. Now put this on here.
The dude is no joke. So he orders an investigation.
Sure.
That investigation is conducted by a gentleman named Georgi Thurzo.
That is a name.
Yeah, Georgi Thurzo. In some accounts, it appears that Thurzo is reported as being Elizabeth's cousin, mm-hmm. though it's unclear. And we should pause here for a moment, because at some point I'm going to have to just address this, that you've already heard me say they had either 5 or 8 kids. You've already heard me say that maybe there was witchcraft. Now I'm saying that maybe Thurzo was her cousin. It is shocking how, for like the position that Bathory has in sort of like people's awareness and pop culture and things like that, mm-hmm. there is very, very little concrete information about her.
Well, I mean, it's the records.
Yes.
I mean, how great are your records from the 1600s?
They're not good.
Right.
So
really at this point, I think it's mostly just like storytelling.
It is. But what's interesting too is that like when you really start to dig in and you look for different sources and things like that, it's all just like quoting each other. You know, there's
right,
not even
right.
like...
There's like 5 things and everyone just keeps...
Yeah, there's like... Yeah, there's like every website that you see is all just kind of circling back on themselves.
Yeah,
you know, there's very, very little information about Elizabeth Bathory. So Georgi Thurzo, maybe her cousin, maybe not. He starts investigating.
I'm sure they were all cousins. I mean, come on.
Well, that's a good point.
How many people are in the royal family there?
That's a very good point. And in the course of his investigation, he interviews over 300 witnesses and starts to gain a little bit of a picture. Here's the things that start coming up from these talks with witnesses. The report that begins to generate is that at some point around the time of Ferenc's death, Elizabeth began killing girls ages 10 to 14 from the nearby villages. These people, these girls that were killed, were typically lesser gentry who would be sent to the court, Elizabeth's court, in order to learn manners, right? You go to court to learn how to become a proper lady, and Elizabeth kills you.
And I'm sure it was like huge privilege, you
right.
know, to be asked, yeah.
Right. And again, and a key, again, here is that these are, you know, definitely, you know, we're in a very hierarchical structure right here,
yeah.
and these are definitely lower tier folks in the hierarchy by a significant margin.
Right.
So, you know, the obvious thought in our day and age is like, well, how could she be killing all these 10 to 14 year old girls? And you're like, well, she's the, you know, she has the castle and they're just like the townsfolk. So,
well,
like,
and it's also not like her parents are allowed to see them after that. Like,
right.
you know, they send the daughter away and that's kind of it until
exactly.
like, you know, they come back. Cause I mean, that's the whole point is
right.
like, we're sending her away for a better life.
She's living
they don't
at
get
court.
To, yeah. They don't have to go hang out.
Right.
So, you know,
right. You may recall we talked about this with him, that he was sent off to another court where he lived his
right.
childhood.
Right. I think that was pretty common.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and then
so
they saw it as an opportunity. I think a lot of times people didn't have and always have the resources for all the children that they had. So, like,
right.
the opportunity to, like, send one of them away to have a better life, you know, was not...
Exactly.
I mean, it was considered, like, a gift.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So it starts coming up that she's been killing. And then starts to become more details that are coming out that are sort of gruesome, right? They start to hear Thurzo in his interviews starts to hear stories of her, you know, impaling girls on needles and her using hot tongs out of the fire to burn girls, or, you know, submerging them in freezing water. Creepy torture-y stuff. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And two court officiants, like at Elizabeth's court, are amongst the people who are interviewed, and they corroborate this. So they kind of say, you know, they're kind of major witnesses, right? It's not just like the townspeople. There's two people at the court who say this as well. So based on that, in December of 1610, Bathory is arrested, along with four of her servants who are identified as her kind of chief accomplices.
And I think by this time, if I'm correct, is that the reason why an investigation is like, there were so many of them.
Yes,
so,
possibly.
Like, it got...
Right.
And people were starting to complain, you know, like big time. Like that's because, I mean, I'm sure this kind of stuff happened a lot in a smaller scale, but it was becoming like a huge scale.
Right. And we'll come back to that.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So December 1610, she's arrested. The story that oftentimes gets told is that when Thurzo and his men show up to arrest her, they catch her covered in blood, like in the act of murdering someone. But it's pretty accepted that that is nonsense, that she was actually just at dinner and when they came in. So that's
just
reading. Yes. Again, it's Elizabeth and four of her servants slash accomplices. Those servants confess to the crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they say, yes, everything that you're saying is true. However, it certainly, all the records indicate that they confessed under torture.
Sure. So you never
from Thurzo and his men. And so it's, you know, so you can't really account for them. And those, and they confess, and then they're promptly executed, like, immediately.
Mm.
So those four servants, yeah, they're tortured, they confess, they die.
Yeah.
So they're not, it's not super helpful.
You know, that's not a great witness.
right. So in 1611, they go to trial. It's a weird system of the court there. Elizabeth is not actually charged with, like, murder.
Mm-hmm.
They're just going to trial to the court to try to determine what happened. We're not, like, formally charging
on
her. We just want to know what's going on.
And that's
here.
Because she's so
Because she's,
high
a, yeah, she's yeah. a countess, right? We can't quite do it. Now, the real difficulty here is that it's sort of, like, everything that they have is all hearsay. Right? It's all this, like, these interviews. You know, I heard this, somebody said this, I saw this. But there's very little concrete, there's virtually no concrete evidence.
Mm-hmm.
In the course of the trial, what the claim is made that Bathory has killed, are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
650 people.
Oh my gosh, it's nuts!
650. But, again, here's the hard part. Where does that information come from, that she killed 650 people? Well, it comes from a servant who reports that at the trial. And that servant overheard it from a court official. And that court official says that they read it in a book that Elizabeth was keeping.
Mm.
So the servant says, I heard this official say that he read in this book that she killed 650 people. There is no record of that book.
Yeah.
And there is no record of that official.
Yeah.
So
it just sounds like a rumor.
Yeah.
That's a really, really high and really specific number.
And especially, for like that, the size of like the town and everything like that, that's a really high
and
number.
And also, it's all like young girls, right? It's like, how many 10 to 14 year olds
right.
do they have in that
650?
Town?
It's a really, really large number.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So that's where the claim is. But again, it's all this kind of hearsay stuff. So the end result of all of this is that she is never officially charged. The trial never reaches any kind of conclusion. She's never charged. She's never convicted, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
She's never acquitted. It just sort of – they just sort of say, we don't really know.
Yeah.
And as a result, they put her on house arrest. But house arrest is just like go to your castle and stay in your castle.
Right.
There again.
Well, wasn't she luring people to the castle? Like, I don't see how that's going to
right.
anything.
I think they watch her. But again, the story becomes that she was That she's sent to her castle, and she's like locked in a certain room and bricked up like a like a Poe person. But that's she just not
had
that's
to
not
stay true. On the castle grounds, which she was probably staying in anyway.
Exactly. And she lives out the rest of her life under house arrest. She dies 3 years later in 1614 at the age of 54 years old, mm-hmm. just at home. So that's. Like, that's the facts of it. That's okay. what we know. That's it's very, very little. So let's talk about kind of the stories and kind of what, you know, what kind of comes up in the tales of Elizabeth, right? So the really big one, obviously, that if you know anything about Elizabeth Bathory, you know that, you know, the big story is that she is known for bathing in the blood of virgins in order to stay young, right? Mm-hmm. That's like what she's commonly known for. That is also why we are drinking a blood orange bourbon sour.
Oh, yay.
I would like to point out that
full
I'm...
circle.
Yeah, thank you. I'd like to point out that I'm running out of blood-related drinks, cocktails. It's getting harder and harder to find them. It's my third, like, vampire story that I've done. So, anyway. So...
You got a theme.
Exactly. So, so that's her big thing that she's known for, right? She bathed in the blood of virgins in order to stay young. But... That concept, that idea of her doing this, the first time that there's ever any recording of that anywhere is in this book called the Tragica Historia in 1729. Not 150, 110 years later. 1729, over 100 years later. It's this idea is never mentioned in any of the witness accounts, mm-hmm. in any of the court documents, nothing. There's nothing about this. So almost certainly something that's completely fabricated later, this idea of her bathing in virgin's blood. Yeah. It's just there's no record of it until 100 years later.
That's interesting.
And an interesting thing that I read is that there's a thought about that idea is that there's a sort of embedded in there that there's a sort of prejudice about gender roles that like, well, the only reason a woman would be murdering people is for vanity, you know, not because she's vicious or cruel or anything, vain and she has to stay young. Right. There is sort of a weird sexist gender role thing to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's kind of the main one.
Or that a woman could be a serial killer. Like there has to, you know.
Yeah, the only way that a woman could.
A witchery thing to
exactly,
it.
Exactly. Yeah, there's some sorcery thing. Right. So that's kind of the main one. But as I said earlier, there's all kinds of stories that come up over time. Again, some contemporary, some later in this Tragica Historia thing, some that have been added over time. But if you look into her, you'll see all kinds of unsubstantiated things, such as... that she would put honey on her victims and then put them outside with ants.
Oh!
That she would bite them on their breasts or on their face. That peasant who fathered mm-hmm. her first child, that she had him fed to dogs. That her husband, Fennec, that he built her a torture chamber. That I got two more. That one of her victims had she forced to cook and eat her own flesh.
Oh, and, it's like the Hannibal movie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that with various victims there was some degree of like genital mutilation.
Sure. Oh,
so these are kind of the stories that go
on. And then the husband was in on it too.
Well,
if he built a torture chamber.
That's in one of the tales. But then a lot of the thought is that this happened after he died. So you know, again, all of these things are tales. They're pretty mm-hmm. relatively unsubstantiated and hard to say. There is a really interesting theory that is out there that is very that I think is worth mentioning and worth thinking about. So, again, the person who launched the investigation was King Matthias II, Holy Roman Emperor, Archduke of Austria, King of Hungary, and King of Croatia. And King Matthias II, interestingly, owed Elizabeth Bathory a very significant amount of money.
Oh.
And through the process of her being through this whole thing, that debt was canceled. Even though she's not technically guilty of these things, but she's guilty enough that she no longer owes Matthias that.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, bear in mind, this all comes out very shortly after her husband dies.
Right.
And the castle is hers, but it was his. He gave it to her.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of questions of, like, is this all a politically motivated conspiracy for people who want to claim her castle?
Or, someone else to take it back.
Yeah, Matthias and other people connected to Matthias want to expand their... He's already, obviously he's a guy who clearly enjoys expanding his foothold in the world.
Right.
Is this an area where he sees, okay... with this husband out of the picture, I can seize this land by painting her as a villain, and I can cancel my debt, and I can claim this land and become my
own. There's nobody to protect her.
Exactly.
Because who's going to believe the woman who's, like, just being like, I'm set up.
Right.
And and you can pay anybody to say anything.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's a very common theory. Now, again, there were 300 witnesses. Some say that there were bodies found in the castle, but were those exaggerated? It's just, we just really, really don't know.
We really don't. It could be a mix of the two.
It could be.
I mean, that's the thing. I think that, the sort of royal families at that time, I mean, they could do whatever they wanted. There was no checks and balances. There was no rules.
Yeah.
So especially against people who were not their own. So I do think that, like, if there was just straight up abuse happening, or if they were, like, mistreating these girls, or, something along those lines.
Yep.
And then you hear about it, and then he decides he's going to go and make a much bigger splash to try to get his stuff back. It could be something like that.
Yeah. Yeah,
300 witnesses is a lot.
Is it 300?
That's what I'm saying. Is there actual written documentation from 300 witnesses and who did it? You know? So,
it's very hard to know.
Yeah.
So it's hard to get to the real details of it. But now here's the last thing. Interestingly, even when you think about, when you start talking about her legacy and what she's, how she's remembered and, like, what happened, even then, the confusion remains. So she dies again in 1614 after being on house arrest for all those years. She's buried in the church, cemetery at the church in town. The village people are not happy about this, and they throw a fit. And so it is agreed that she is moved back to, her body is exhumed and moved back to her birth home and the family crypt there. But the exact location is unknown. No, it's unknown where her body is today.
Oh, wow.
Nobody knows. So
that's really interesting.
So there's that. She also... Here's a couple of the big things that she's known for. Number one, the virgin's blood thing, which seems almost surely false. Number two, a lot of times she is cited as being one of Bram Stoker's inspirations for Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
That is completely unsubstantiated and not supported by any documentation from Bram Stoker himself at all. There's no, his journals.
Wasn't any of his notebooks.
His notebooks, his records, nothing. So that seems like it's kind of hogwash. If you look at, you look at sites and articles and stuff, and this kind of goes back to my teaser, she's very often cited as, quote, the world's most notorious or most prolific female serial killer. And many times they say in the Guinness Book of World Records, she's the most prolific female serial killer. Guinness actually has a website that you can go to and, like, search their record books.
They would need proof, right?
Yeah, there's no record of this in Guinness. Yeah. So I even think that is nonsense.
Yeah.
Even people saying that she's cited this way in Guinness. I think
that sounds
even
like a,
that is
yeah,
not true.
That sounds like a Ripley's Believe It or Not thing.
Right, yeah. Right. But yeah, so it's interesting. She did one sort of a final note that I thought was interesting. She's been featured in a ton of, like, pop culture things, right? Books and movies and stuff like that. I could go on and on about the things she's been listed in. But two that I thought were worth mentioning that I think are interesting. One, she's the inspiration for a novella titled Eternal Youth.
Ooh.
By a guy named Leopold von Sacher-Masoch, or Masoch. M-A-S-O-C-H, von Sacher-Masoch, whose name, Masoch, would ultimately become the word masochism. He's the guy who kind of coined the idea of masochism.
Oh.
And he wrote this novella about her.
Oh.
Interesting, eh?
Yikes. He's like, this is my kind of story.
Yep. And then the last one, she is the villain in a 2009 novel called Dracula the Undead, which is by... Dacre? D-A-C-R-E? Dacre?
Yeah.
Dacre? Yeah. Stoker, a descendant of Bram Stoker.
Wow.
Who wrote this sort of pseudo sequel to Dracula in 2009 and made her the villain. In that, I love this. This sounds like the most insane book ever. I kind of want to track it down. In it, Bathory is A, Dracula's cousin.
Sure.
B, is Jack the Ripper.
Sure, okay.
And the plot is that Dracula comes to London to stop her murdering people, murdering the prostitutes of Whitechapel.
That story sells itself.
That's an insane concept
for
a book.
Come on.
So Dracula the Undead.
He's hitting all the major points.
Yeah, fascinating.
Imagine being a descendant of Bram Stoker, and then you're like, I'm going to write a Dracula book, too.
Yeah, Dracula 2.
Dracula 2.
Let's do this.
By the other Bram Stoker guy.
Yeah. So anyway, there you go.
That's funny.
So, I have to admit, there were points in this that I kind of thought, geez, I don't know if I should even do this story because I can't, there's so little factual information.
You ruined the horror for everyone.
I wish I could pin it down, but no. There's not much to pin down.
That's generally, I think, when the stories are so old and there isn't documentation,
right.
You know, like, that's kind of how you go. I mean, same with Dracula, like Vlad Dracula. I mean, there's only so much that you know. You know that he was born at this time and his name is this. You know, he conquered it. But, like, we don't know how much of it is rumor.
Exactly.
So
it'll remain a mystery.
I will feel very sad if all this time I thought she would. I didn't think she killed 650 people, but I thought she was some type of murderer. I guess I would feel very sad if, like, all this time she really didn't do anything.
Who knows?
She was just trying to steal her land.
I know. Hard to
and
say.
She's just vilified forever. But, I mean, I have to say, probably most of the people from that time period, in the royal court, they're all forgotten. She is very famous.
She is very famous.
She is well known forever.
Yeah. She was not Vavoid, but her grandpa was, but nobody knows his name.
Right?
So, there you go.
All right.
There you have it. So, anyway.
Good job.
Thank you. Cheers. Not necessarily to Elizabeth, but, you know.
Well, depending on what she did.
Maybe. A tentative cheers to her.
This week got a little weird.
All right.
I was in a mood. I just was trying to find something different.
You're like, I'm bathing in some blood of virgins.
Bathing in a little bit of blood. That's the other question. Did it work? Nobody ever talks about that. Like, did it actually work?
I don't know. She died at 54.
Yeah. But like, how did she look? That's what I'm just kidding. Anyway. Okay. I am doing the Kentucky Meat Shower of 1876.
I'm just gonna say it again. The Kentucky Meat Shower
of 1876.
I'm gonna write that down.
That's correct. Okay, you don't know the story?
No, I don't know the story of the Kentucky Meat Shower of 1876.
I mean, it is a name. First of all, we need a t-shirt with that on it.
Absolutely.
And then we need to wear it.
Incredible.
Okay. You ready?
Oh, I'm ready.
Okay. It's March 3rd, it's 1876,
naturally.
And it's about 11 a.m. in Bath County, Kentucky. We have Mr. and Mrs. Crouch. They live on a farm, and Mrs. Crouch is outside on her porch. She's making soap, as you do. It's early spring. She's out there. I don't know really how you make soap, but I'm assuming that it involves like a tub.
You did a story about someone making soap out of dead bodies.
Oh,
I'm assuming that Crouch
yes.
is not making it out of dead bodies.
She's not making it out of dead bodies. But yeah, she like spun it. All right.
Sure.
Yeah. So yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway. So Mrs. Crouch is outside. She's making soap. And she walks about 40. She said she's about 40 steps in front of her house. And then she looks up and she sees something falling from the sky. And it hits the ground beside her. So she's like, what was that? She leans down to look closer, and then she sees it is a grisly-looking chunk of meat.
Okay.
Then the downpour starts.
Oh, my God.
For around 5 to 10 minutes that morning, chunks of red meat rain down on Mrs. Crouch and the surrounding area. It's about 100 by 50-yard radius.
That's big.
Yes, that's about the length of a football field.
Yeah, that's large.
The meat chunks are later measured. They're about 2 by 2 inches. And so, I mean, that's like a cube of meat.
Yeah, that's...
So let's stop for a second.
That's not insignificant.
It's a cube of meat. So, like, if you're making, like, a beef stew...
Yeah.
That would be, like, the size of your beef stew meat.
It's like the size of our big ice cubes in our
drinks. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's even bigger.
Yeah, that's about that.
So if you get really fancy cocktail ice cubes, it's about that size, which is, that's quite large.
Yeah.
And then, like, the palm of your hand, probably. And then it's raining down in a 100 yard radius, like the size of a football field, for like 10 minutes.
That's just a lot of meat.
It's a ton of meat.
Yeah.
Raining on Mrs. Crouch and her neighbors. So they measure them afterwards. I'm sure people are just like running out of their house being like, what was that?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's 2 by 2 inches. And at first it appears to be beef. That's what they first decide.
Great.
This phenomenon is reported. It's all over the place. It's
well, sure.
All kinds of papers, right? It's, and it's reported by Scientific American and the New York Times and like really well regarded publications. So it's not, you know, I mean, this is a documented story happened. One article in the New York Times, reports that, quote, the sky was, this is from Mrs. Crouch. The sky was perfectly clear. The person who wrote the New York Times report. The sky was perfectly clear at the time, and she said it felt like large snowflakes. One piece fell near her, which was 3 to 4 inches square.
Ugh, gosh, okay.
Yeah.
Gross, okay.
Gross, right? And also, like, the smell.
Ugh, yeah,
there's it a must lot of have here. Smelled. Okay. So Mrs. Crouch, so it's like, what happened? What is this?
Yeah, obviously.
What's
that's
going
the question.
On?
Yeah.
Mrs. Crouch and her husband believed that the event was a sign from God.
Sure.
Okay. So this is Mrs. Crouch's theory.
Okay.
Two local men claimed that the meat was raw and it tasted like mutton or venison. And another local hunter claimed that it was bear meat. How did they know? Because they ate it.
Whoa, no, you can't eat the meat that falls from the sky.
Several people in the town put the meat from the sky into their mouths
to see
what kind of meat it might be.
Oh.
Yeah.
That seems like a bad choice. It's a really bad choice.
I can't even imagine a worse choice.
Oh, man.
It's so terrible. They're smelling it, they're picking it up, and then they put it in their mouth.
Rough.
So, there's arguments. Some say muttons.
Did they turn to mutants? Is that where this story is going?
And it's like, if you do, that's on you. You deserved it. You put it in your mouth.
Oh, that's
Don't bad. Touch meat that just falls out of the sky. It
falls out of the sky and lands in a field.
Don't touch it. Don't eat it.
Ugh.
All right. So maybe mutton, maybe venison, maybe bear meat.
Okay.
The meat was also eaten by the Crouch family cat.
I mean, that's, you know, sure.
That's the thing. Let the cat
the
eat
cat
it. Because you can't stop that. Cat's eating it. The cat's going to get it before anybody even can do anything about it.
Yeah.
And then you see what happens to the cat.
Yep. Yep. You put the cat in some sort of locked sort of room
quarantine.
To see if it turns into a zombie cat.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
Oh, man. Okay. So a meat sample was given to the Newark Scientific Association for further analysis.
Either one. It's fine. That's the bourbon.
I know. I've been eating sky meat. Okay. Anyway. So, but I mean, this is 1876. So I don't know how much analyzing they were doing of the meat.
Go, yeah.
All right. So here are the theories.
Okay.
Of the meat. Number one, sign from God. That's from Mrs. Crouch.
Yep. Absolutely.
You know, she talked about that at church.
Oh,
forever. But like, what is the sign though? That's my question. What is God trying to tell you by dropping a whole bunch of meat on you?
That you should eat the meat. It's God's meat. He passed it on to you to eat.
Like, eat the meat, everyone.
Don't be starving. Don't be hungry.
Have some meat.
Eat my meat.
What if it was something like, you know, like, stop swearing?
Maybe.
That's his way of telling you.
Yeah.
You know, she used it for anything that she didn't want other people doing. She's like, God sent that meat here for you to stop that. Like, she used it constantly.
Yeah.
It's like 20 years later. She's like saying it to her
kids.
Do you
think that a priest, one of the preachers there said like, you know, and God said, let there be meat? That seems like the line to use.
It's a missed opportunity if it wasn't. All right.
Okay.
So that's number one. Number two, that the meat was actually something called, all right, I can't even, Nostoc?
Sure.
All right. N-O-S-T-O-C.
Nostoc.
Nostoc. Which is a type of bacteria that swells to look like a clump of seaweed when it's exposed to moisture. Nostoc expands into like a clear jelly-like mass, and then when rain falls on it gives it like the sense that it's coming with the rain.
Okay.
So it's like a bacteria that like gets swollen and it looks kind of clumpy, like a seaweed clump.
So, but it didn't actually fall. It got activated by the rain.
Then if it starts to rain, the rain sort of activates it coming with it. But
it's not meat.
Right. That's one of the theories, which I would also want to point out. Somebody, if that's the truth,
somebody ate that thing.
People put that in their mouths.
Yeah. Okay.
But they did lab tests and it showed that the meat was bits of muscle, lung, and cartilage.
Jeez, okay.
And it also wasn't raining that day. Because like, the whole thing with the Nostoc is like it mixes with rain when it falls. And there was like no rain that day. It was like a perfectly clear day. So they were able to tell that it was like muscle, lung, and cartilage.
Okay.
So gross.
That's a lot. Okay.
Okay. So one of the
human muscle, lung, and cartilage?
They don't know.
No, cartilage? Okay.
So one of the other theories is that two brothers in like a nearby area. So they're in Bath County, Kentucky, which is like Olympia Springs, I guess is like the...
Okay.
I don't know. You know. Anyway. Two brothers get into a knife fight around that same time. A twister picks up the gory carnage of the brothers and then like rains it over this area.
That seems like the stupidest theory of all three.
I'm just telling you that's what they had.
Oh man, I'm willing to accept sign from God before I'm willing to go with that one. Okay.
Okay. Another theory, possibly the most fun, was proposed by humorist William Livingston Alden.
Oh, I love people who are classified as humorists.
What does that mean? Humorist? Just like a funny writer?
It's like Mark Twain. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mark Twain is a humorist.
Funny writer.
Funny writer.
Just, you know, but like...
A comedian before they had comedians.
Or but like talking about a like specific... Yeah, I guess you're right.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway. All right. So William Livingston Alden decides that he's going to get in on this.
Sure.
And he writes a New York Times article, which was published March 11th, 1876, so like right after it happened. And he says, and he is quoted, "The obvious conclusion is that the Kentucky meat shower was a really a meteoric shower. The article explains that since meteoric stones, they constantly revolve around the sun. And so that would mean that there revolves around the sun a belt of venison, mutton, and other meats. They're divided into small fragments, which are then precipitated about the earth."
Awesome.
So this is Alden's theory, right? There's just like a big
belt of meat.
Circle belt of meat around the earth.
Nice.
And it just kind of gets broken up into tiny fragments, and occasionally it gets rained down to the earth.
Nice.
So, I mean, when you think everyone was like, what?
I love it. He's a humorist. He's having a good time.
Yeah, and he also says it so, like, for sure, of course.
That's great.
So Alden explains that previously scientists had theorized that meteors were exploded planets. So the meteor shower must be inhabitants who formerly occupied the wrecked planet. So basically, taking it a step further, the meat shower, the meat that gets sent around the Earth, that gets orbited, is actually meat from planets that exploded and, like, the people who were on
them. All right.
That's where you get the cartilage and the muscle and the lung. So he's basically saying it's alien.
Okay. Is y'all just basing this on the fact that it's called a meteor shower? Is that, like, the whole root of his theory?
Meat, meteor.
I got a theory.
That's it.
All right.
But, I mean, come on. This is an amazing story to just create and be like, that's what it is.
Yeah.
So he suggests to the scientists that they create better technology so that they can start predicting meat rain just like they predict regular rain.
This guy's amazing. Okay.
And he's quoted as saying, "Light showers of beefsteak may be looked for in the New England and Middle States during the morning, followed by a heavy rain of mutton in the afternoon." Well,
love this guy.
Okay. I know.
Great.
Now, he's probably making fun of it all.
Sure.
But sure. He might be serious.
But he's grand. Okay.
All right. So moving a little bit closer to, you know, our time period here. It's the late 1980s.
Oh, nice. Okay.
All right. Again, I got to know. I actually looked this name up and I can't remember. It's Kurt
Gode.
Gode. It's Gode, I think. Okay, Gode. It's German. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So we have Kurt Gode in his 1980s. He is a professor of art at, you ready, Transylvania University.
Hey, Transylvania University? Like in Transylvania?
No, it's somewhere in the U.S.
Well, that seems lame. Okay.
Right? Because he's in the U.S. We'll look it up later. Anyway, okay.
Yeah, okay.
So he's in Kentucky. He's living in Kentucky, and he gets really interested in, like, this history and the Kentucky meat shower.
Okay.
And he's sort of, like, asking around about it, like, locally and, like, as he meets people. And, like, nobody knows what he's talking about. It's, like, not something that's taught. It's not something that anybody really knows about. Did you look it up?
It's a private college in Lexington,
yes, in Kentucky. Yeah, that's what I thought.
What the heck? How bizarre. I know, right? Why are they called Transylvania University?
Why not? Does it look spooky? Let me see. I don't know. It just looks very...
Are there mascots like the bats or something like that?
It needs to be.
No, it's just a regular old school.
It's called Transy.
Wow. How weird. All right.
Okay. Everybody, if you learned anything tonight, there's a Transylvania University in Lexington, Kentucky.
Lexington, Kentucky.
Oh, look at that guy. Henry Clay.
That's Henry Clay. He was there. All right. Anyway. Yeah. There
okay.
we go.
Anyway. Sorry. Okay.
Fascinating.
So Kurt Goda, he moves to Lexington. He's working at Transylvania University, and he's really into the Kentucky meat shower, which, I mean, I would be
sure.
too. So nobody really knows about it. He gets more into it. He starts doing a bunch of research. And they refer to him in this article as the foremost expert on meat writing.
Oh, amazing. Incredible.
Which I'm like, if I could have that title, I feel like I did something in my life.
I did it.
All right. So he's reading about the incident in a strange weather phenomenon book, and he moves from upstate New York. And so he's asking his students about it. Nobody knows what he's talking about. He starts looking into it more, and he kind of refines all those theories that we talked about.
Got it.
He also makes some new discoveries. He discovers that there's no explanation was ever really discovered or decided by the residents of Bath Springs.
Didn't get past the, like, theories.
Right. Yeah. So there was no, like, sort of, hey, we've decided that this is what it is, or, you know, whatever. Even, like, everybody had a different idea. It just kind of was, like, a very unexplained thing, and that's where it was left. And interestingly, he's quoted as saying, in 1876, the idea of solving every riddle just didn't exist yet. So people were largely okay with a relatively plausible solution, and they would just move on. I find that
That's really interesting.
Because I think it's so true, right? It's like you didn't have the means to, like, go to a library and look stuff up and, like, research things or on a computer or talk to scientists or have, you know, so you're just kind of
like, okay,
listen. Sign from God.
Yeah.
Listen, you know.
That's interesting.
Like,
yeah.
Two guys were fighting over there. Maybe the wind picked up their meat.
Yeah. Who knows?
Whatever. So then Kurt is clearing out storage closets at Transylvania University, as you do. And he stumbles upon, are you ready for this? An old glass jar. And it's, like, sealed with a cork stopper.
Okay.
And he's like, what is this? So it's got like a faded label, and then the words Olympia Springs are on the label. He can, like, just make it out.
Oh.
It contains a chunk of what?
Of the meat?
Of white, fatty-looking meat suspended in pale yellow liquid.
Oh, okay, okay.
So he gets really excited. It's discovered that this is, like, you know, the remaining piece of, you know, like, meat that they sent off for testing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that it's, like, still there.
There it is. Okay.
So Kurt works with a colleague. He goes to the biology department. You know, you're at a big university.
Yep.
And then he asks to get it, the sample, genetically tested. So, unfortunately, it was too old and it was too contaminated and it didn't really give any results. And then he sent it off to, he's like, I'm not done yet. So he sends it off to a lab in Cincinnati that apparently analyzes, like, flavor compounds.
Okay, sure.
So it's like, you're going to... Now, I don't know how they do that, and I hope no one's tasting it.
No, I'm sure. No, yeah, I'm sure yeah, not. Yeah. yeah, yeah, right.
But they can, like, break down the flavors of it and then tell you what the flavors are. So he asked them to do that at this place, and apparently what they do there is they break down the flavors, and then they reconstruct those flavors into a jelly bean.
Oh, sure. Okay, that makes sense. I get that. Yeah.
And you didn't see that coming.
No, but I get it.
So then, because Kurt is so curious and he wants to know what it is and what it tastes like. So then he drives to Cincinnati. He picks up over 1,000 meat shower jelly beans.
Wow.
And then in these little tins, And he takes him back with him.
Okay.
So he's all excited. He waits till he gets home. He says he parks in his driveway, and then he puts one in his mouth.
How does he have the self-restraint to
wait till you get home?
Jeez, okay.
Okay, he's quoted as saying, "The taste, frankly, is so vile. I remember thinking it was really strong. The first one I ate tasted like chemicals and sugar," which you're kind of like,
well, what it was, yeah.
So then now it's like 2007, and he's... So Lexington, or they have something called Kentucky Court Days, which is like this huge outdoor event. And I don't know exactly what it is, but it has a Ren Faire feel sounding name to me. So I'm going to assume it's that. So he's there and he's handing out meat flavored jelly beans and then explaining to all the people about the Kentucky Meat Shower because people don't really know about it. Which I'm like, why am I not at this
incredible this is the best
court day with this guy and getting a meat flavored jelly bean? It would be the best day of my life.
Absolutely.
All right.
Can you imagine going back to the office the next day, Monday, and being like you guys, I'm never going to believe what this jelly bean is.
You guys, I got meat flavored jelly beans. No, meat flavored jelly beans from 1876.
From this guy.
It reminds me of the time that we got those durian
Those durian candies. Yeah, those were terrible.
And so if you guys don't know what durian fruit is, it's like that. It's a fruit. It smells really terrible. It smells like rotting flesh.
Yeah.
And then it tastes quite as awful. And then we found durian like candies in some market in New York, right?
Yeah, in Chinatown in New York.
Yeah. And then we bought a bunch of them and then we just left them in a dish out in our apartment.
Yeah, people would just eat them. Good times. Good times. Just being like, oh, a candy.
And then they'd be like, oh, like this is just awful. Like
it was great.
Oh, it was the best. We were awesome.
That was good stuff.
Okay, anyway. So we're just like, yeah, I just have one.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
They made you burp too, I remember. And then so you would the taste would come back for hours every once in a while. Oh, those were terrible.
I can't believe
they were bad.
Still came over after we did that. Amazing.
Here, wash it down with this malort. That was our other go to. Oh, we were mean.
Durian fruit candy and malort.
Oh.
Come to our house.
Terrible.
Good times. Okay, anyway, so here is our final theory.
Is this from him?
Yes, this is from Kurtz, from all of his research and, you know, everything.
World's foremost expert on meat shows.
Exactly. Okay, so he looks in articles published in the Louisville Medical News, the American Journal of Microscopy. Am I saying that right? Yeah, 1876. Whatever. And then all kind of with the scientists. Because, again, this was a huge story at the time, and they tried to, you know, they did a lot of, like, you know, theories and all that kind of stuff. So, many scientists at that time believed that the meat shower was a result of vomiting vultures.
Oh, man. Why would all the vultures suddenly vomit?
Okay, you gotta listen up.
Okay.
So, this was... So, an Ohio farmer... whose name was never written down, unfortunately, was the one to propose this. And then the scientists kind of like delved into it to see if it was like possible. Okay, so Kentucky is home to turkey vultures. Didn't know that.
Okay.
So turkey vultures gorge on, like they eat carrion, like dead meat, whatever. And then, but they will overeat. They'll gorge on it. And when they do that, it like limits their ability to fly.
Got it.
So when they eat too much of it, which they always do, then they can't fly very well because they're too stuffed.
They're eating too much food,
Right. And then, so I think generally what they do is they just, like, hang out until they digest it, you know, and then they fly. But if the birds are, like, spooked or scared in some way, they will immediately take flight. Like, they have to take flight.
Yeah, right.
Their stomachs are super full and it makes it hard for them to fly. So when that situation happens, okay, they ate too much, they can't fly very well, suddenly something freaks them out, and then they have to take flight, they will regurgitate their last meal in flight.
Right, to lighten their load so that they can fly for
safety. So they'll, like, barf it out as they're flying. So that's a thing. That's a known thing.
Okay.
It happens. So the theory is that, like, a bunch of vultures were... if they had eaten a bunch of something that was dead, and then they all sort of flew at the same time, they're all spooked
and then
got
spooked by something,
and then they all regurgitated at the exact same time,
and then the hunters ate it.
Mrs. Crouch, yes, and then people put it in their mouth.
Just to be clear. Okay, all right. Oh,
so that's the most
okay.
accepted theory. This was presented by the Louisville Medical News as the best explanation of why the meats were all different.
Sure.
Why they couldn't why some was venison, some was deer meat, some was this, because they were different meats.
Why that one guy was like, I taste a hint of beef in this one.
Exactly.
No, I taste bear.
Yeah. Oh God. It was all different meat. And then another article thought that it was possible that the vultures feasted on sheep that were treated at the time with strychnine, which was a poison that was used to target coyotes. So apparently, I guess the farmers would give some of the sheep strychnine, and then the coyotes would eat them, and then it would kill the coyotes. But then I'm also like, but you also lost your sheep.
That's their problem.
Whatever. Anyway, so the vultures may have also vomited in response because they ate poisoned meat.
Okay.
Which would maybe make a little bit more sense of like why so many of them vomited at the same time.
Yeah, but that wouldn't
flight. But they had to have still been freaked out.
To me, that wouldn't make sense for why they did it at the same time. Like, if you get like food poisoning, if you and I eat the same food that gives us both food poisoning, we don't then throw up instantly at the same moment.
Yeah, that's.
But if you're disgorging it,
yeah,
because you're spooked by something,
they're all doing it. At the same time.
Because they all got spooked by that same thing, right?
There, yeah,
you know.
I mean, it definitely is a plausible. Okay. But I mean, it was a football field size for 10 minutes.
It's a lot of vultures.
How many vultures were up there?
All right.
Oh, gross. Okay. So a lot of the locals at the time did go with that theory. That was sort of a well thought one. That one, and then sign from God. And then it was also apparently what also held up this theory was there was like flattened meat chunks that were the result of pressure, like 9 days later, rained down in like a nearby place. And then something, I don't know, some other things like rained down upper London. I don't really understand what's going on there.
But all right.
Okay. So, Kurt has been working on a community art project that would recreate the Kentucky meat shower of 1876 by dropping meat over the sky in the area.
I'm sorry. He's working on a community art project that will recreate this.
Correct. That was in, I did not find any information about that actually happening.
Oh man.
But yeah.
We're gonna have to find out. We're gonna have to find this guy.
Yeah.
We're gonna have to link to him. We're gonna have to ask people if this has not happened yet to support this community art project, because I want to see meat fall from the sky as a community art project. That sounds amazing.
I want a large group of people all working together on this for like at least a couple of weeks.
Yes.
If not a month, and then have it happen. But I'm gonna guess. I don't think it's happened because I feel like I would have heard about it.
Sure.
Because we're close to Kentucky, too.
Does he make it edible if he does this art project? Can I then pick it up and eat it?
I mean, I think he wants it to be, like, for reals meat.
Oh, sweet.
But I wonder, yeah, I don't know. I'm sure it's not an easy thing to pull off.
No. We're going to look this up.
That is the Kentucky Meat Shower of 1876.
Incredible.
Yep.
That's great stuff. Wow.
That is just a nut story.
That's totally bonkers.
And here's the thing. I was going to do more of this, and then I just didn't. But there is, like, a whole... there's a phenomenon of just, like, things raining from the sky.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've heard ones about, like, the fish and,
yeah,
like, all that
fish,
kind of
stuff. Yeah, there's fish, the frogs, you know. Yeah. I mean...
It's a magnolia.
Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, it's a thing that happens sometimes.
Yeah.
And there's just no... And, I mean, they're documented things, and sometimes they're filmed. But there's just, like, no real explanation for it. I think this stuff with like the fish and the frogs and stuff like that is like some sort of like a tornado picked it up
and dumped
it somewhere. But even then you're just like, how many frogs are in that pond?
Like, fascinating.
That they got. And why just the frogs? Why wouldn't it be all the water and other stuff too?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Why would it only be picking up frogs or fish?
Right. Oh, so fascinating.
Anyway, all
right,
this stuff is nuts. So
good stuff. Thanks.
You're welcome.
All right. Real quick. Last question. Just close this out. Just a simple yes or no answer. Can't elaborate. Do you think that if you watched Magnolia today, you would feel that it was a good movie?
No.
All right, fair enough.
Didn't think it was the first time around.
All right. What? You're not supposed to elaborate.
I'm sorry.
Just a no.
No. Right. The answer is no.
Okay. Just curious. And that's the end of our show.
Yay!
Yay! There we go. Some weird stuff today.
Yeah, it was a weird. It was good though.
It's all right.
It's my fave.
Creepy and weird.
Yep.
So thanks.
All right, we'll see you next week.
We'll be back with more next week. See you next time. Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, this is Fraser with information on next week's Creepy Cocktail. Next week, we'll be having the classic gimlet. So for this, you need 2 ounces of gin, 3/4 ounces fresh lime, and 3/4 ounce simple syrup. I strongly encourage you to take the time to use fresh lime and also make your own simple syrup. So take all those ingredients, shake them over ice, pour them in, strain them into a glass, and you've got yourself a gimlet. Garnish it with a lime wedge as well. So we hope you'll make one of those and join us when we are back next week. Until then, please follow us on Twitter at CreepyHist and on Instagram at CreepyHistPod. Thank you very much. We'll see ya.